Every week on a Friday, Andrea Burns, who's been teaching the next generation of journos and broadcasters out at ECU, she joins me in the studio to ponder what happened, what happens next. And each week we like to turn our attention across the vast pool of Perth people who do remarkable things. And I think we might have one of the best today.
What just happened?
Well, the man in front of us blushed, which is what we wanted. Andrea, hello to you.
Hello to you, Geoffrey. And I do agree that we've got one of the best and one of the most interesting and, dare I say it, even one of the nicest smart people around.
Andrew Whitehouse, distinguished scholar, researcher, clinician. He and his team at the Telethon Kids Institute have rewritten the book on what we know about autism, how to diagnose it, how to support kids and families, a nominee in the West Australian Australian of the Year Awards. Hello to you, Andrew.
Oh, I feel a little bit embarrassed about that. Thank you.
Oh, stop it.
Hey, I did say earlier you're a modest man of far from modest talents. Are you and your brother identically clever?
Depends who you ask and depends on what day. I'm by far the least sort of impressive of my family, and so we're always trying to one-up each other. He's in child protection and just an incredibly talented, bright and compassionate fella, and I'm always trying to meet up to that.
Wow.
And that is what interests me about you, Andrew, and always has, because our paths have crossed many times over the years, that in our world, a scientist who can speak in everyday terms is an endangered species, but you have the heart and the head going with this stuff, and your passion for autism is extraordinary. But where does it come from?
Oh, thank you, Andrea. Look, I mean, it comes right back to the late 1990s, and people forget this time now that, you know, we'd had the AIDS epidemic, and so there was a bit of a void to fill, and because the AIDS epidemic had gone and autism sort of came along, and all of a sudden we were diagnosing these huge numbers of kids with autism, and we forget now, but it was a scary time for many young families. And I had a couple of experiences, one in particular during my clinical training where I went to provide a bit of support to a family, and I didn't see the Grim Reaper. I didn't see anything to be afraid of. I saw a family who was struggling, and I saw how much love that they emanated for their child. I still remember the mum said, I didn't know I had this amount of love in me until I met my child. And I just got addicted to that love. I got addicted to that story, and I just wanted to help them tell it.
And is there an extension of that story where you were also aware that there were those offering a certain snake oil is perhaps an unfair reflection of what was being offered, but those same families were being offered things that did not have any basis in real science, did they?
We actually all were in the late 1990s. I look back to what we were all doing and what we considered evidence-based. And, you know, it wasn't institutionalisation, but we weren't too far from it. And all we wanted to do, we just needed to get better. And I realised love would get you so far, but we needed science to get us further.
Andrew, I remember speaking to a creative person who came up with some, I can't remember what the exhibition was, but he was ADHD or something, and he said, I couldn't be who I am without the ADHD, and so for me it is not a disability, it's just me. Is it similar for people with autism?
Oh, absolutely. Look, the last 10 years we've seen a huge, really a civil rights movement around that autism is not something I have, it's something I am. And I think that's just a beautiful reframing. The challenge comes, of course, is that sometimes there are things that come along with autism that aren't choices and they aren't benefits to their life. And that's where someone like me comes in, is that how can I remove those barriers from your life so you can be who you want to be? That's my job.
We'll talk about that in detail in a moment. Can you take us back to 24-year-old you in Oxford studying? So it's early this century. What was that experience like?
Oh, it was fantastic. Look, I jetted off there relatively early in life, and I became what was called a fellow, which meant that sort of, you know, I pounced around in a gown, and you know, people would have to doff their cap at me,
really?
At, you know, all the age of 24, and it was absolutely ridiculous. But on the science front, it was the most exciting time. The human genome had just been sequenced. We knew all the secrets of what was in our DNA, And Oxford was really the hub of that. And people were discovering genes every night. Every night we would go to the pub. I mean, quite literally every night. And there would be people coming, I've just discovered the genes for this. I've just discovered the gene for that. And it was their round, of course, after that. And sometimes there were some long nights. So,
And what does that do to you? Does that convince you that everything is possible?
I think that the Human Genome Project was a huge step forward, scientifically speaking. What it wasn't a step forward in is actually understanding people. It was understanding biology, but layered on top of people is our soul, it's our experience, it's our childhood, it's our parents, it's all of that. And I got to the point after all of that excitement of discovering and a huge amount of booze, that actually what really spoke to me was the other stuff that makes us human. And when I think about the thousands of families I see, that's what they want. They want to know biology, but more importantly, what they want is to know who they are and who their child is.
So post-Oxford, you come back to Western Australia, and then what?
Oh, look, I was leaving. I was absolutely leaving science because we were discovering genes all the time, but it was not connected to making a difference, and all of that human storytelling that was so powerful to people I was seeking to support. And so I applied for another, I applied to leave science, and I was lucky enough to get a job in the public service. And I received a call from Fiona Stanley, who said, oh, look, come on, just give it one more shot. Give it one more shot and be true to who you are. And so I decided to give it 1 year, and that was at the Telethon Kids Institute. And I decided that if it does me out of a job, all I'm going to do is concentrate on how we can best help these families rather than discover biology. It was about how we can help the family.
When Fiona Stanley rings and tells you to do something, only a fool would say no. Professor Andrew Whitehouse joins Andrea Burns and me for What Just Happened at 11 minutes to 5 on this Friday afternoon on ABC Radio Perth. So let's talk a little bit about what the last 10 years have been like for you. The science is important to you, but the application of that science into the lives of families is more important to you.
Yeah, it's absolutely right that it's interesting what you said before, Andrew, regarding the job of a scientist. Science is about it. Science is not even worth having unless it gets into the hands of people who need it and want it and can thrive through it. And so I've seen a lot of my job as absolutely driving some of the science and trying to create new knowledge that can create change, but it's actually creating that change where I've concentrated my efforts. And so I've done a lot of the boring job of policy work, but trying to move policy levers to actually help policymakers understand how you can better create policy settings that make a difference to these families' lives. But I've also developed a deep, genuine understanding that all change is local. You can do whatever policy settings you want, but all change happens one-on-one with that family. And that's just everything.
Can we just ask you about what you do with that family? Mm. So get a little closer into your relationship with parents and kids, dealing with all that emotional range, hope and anguish and expectation. Yeah. What do you do with those families?
Oh, look, it all stems back to the question of who are you? You know, what story do you have to tell, and how can I help you tell that story? And so firstly, it's just understanding their journey first to that point when they first see you. And often it's been a pretty bruising journey, firstly discovering their child is developing differently and then actually navigating a system that can be very challenging at times. And then it's understanding what their goals are. What do you want for your child? You know, back 20, 30 years ago, it might have been all about talking. It might have been all about toileting. Now it might be more about connecting. It might be connecting with the family. It might be connecting with a sporting club. It might be connecting there. But more often than not, it's a combination of those two. And lucky enough, I work with an extraordinarily bright and talented team who work with these families to help them pursue their goals through speech pathology, occupational therapy, psychology, and all of the other things that we're sort of developing and trying to get into their hands.
Where does that worldview come from, though? Because for many people in science, it is about the science. Mm. And yet the advocates that you speak of, who that footy coach or that whatever coach, they're more likely to be incidental people in that child's life who might have an impact. How do you get that? Where does that come from? Is that your family bleeding through into your work?
I think, look, I certainly grew up in a very politically active family, and that was a real privilege in retrospect. Sometimes it could have been a bit of a burden, but it was a real privilege in retrospect. I think also that I had a front row seat to Fiona Stanley, and that was a genuine privilege to understand the impact that she made through communicating and forcefully, but respectfully and genuinely, how we can better support people. And finally, I really think it actually comes from seeing thousands of families. Their stories are worthwhile. Their stories are valuable. Their lives are valuable. Their children are valuable. And those stories need to be told.
Let's talk about Clinic Kids. What is it?
Clinic Kids is the essentially the community health arm of the Telethon Kids Institute. About 5 years ago, I realised we were doing all this wonderful science, but nothing was getting into the community. There's a 20-year gap between science being settled and something getting into clinical practice. I realised that actually we needed to be the change that we wanted to see, and there was no centre that was actually a centre in which we could deliver clinical services and families could actually enter into cutting-edge clinical trials. And so at the Telethon Kids Institute, we developed that, and we're lucky we're a network of sites up in Joondalup, in Subiaco, and growing even further with hundreds of families involved who are not just receiving services but actually contributing to the next generation. Real privilege.
You've also been instrumental in FACES, which is the development of a school for autism, for children with autism. Now, I declare an interest here in that one of my dearest friends is behind this and has worked quite comprehensively with Andrew. But that's a big step for parents with children with autism, isn't it? Because, well, explain.
Yeah, without a doubt. Look, schooling, we are getting better and better in helping families support their child very early in life and delivering them to school at a certain point where they're ready and to absorb and learn. The schooling system is a massive challenge at the moment, and I know the radio airwaves are full of this.
Yeah.
Schools simply aren't geared to provide an environment that is suited to all kids on the autism spectrum, and I'm committed to try to find ways that gives families choice in how they can educate their children. That might be through education support units, through mainstreaming, through autism-specific schools. The key thing that we have to do is help kids learn in a way that is best for them and that will help their family thrive. Without their family, they don't have anything.
Do you marvel at the breadth of that spectrum as we know it today? And it's funny, you know, how casually members of the community might do some little self-diagnosis or diagnosis of other people on the spectrum. That'd be on the spectrum, on the spectrum. But increasingly you also hear from people who say, this is how I've been diagnosed. I've been diagnosed as an adult. This is where I'm at. How would you describe how incredible that spectrum is?
Oh, it's extraordinarily broad, and that's a function of how we diagnose. We diagnose autism based on social communication difficulties and repetitive behaviours, and people can have an intellectual disability or be extremely highly intelligent and everything in between. And so, yes, absolutely, we just see huge breadth in the kids that we see. Could have a child who's 5 and not toileting in one session, and then the next session it might be a child who's 5 and is reading Shakespeare. You know,
it's like throwing the net over all of us, isn't it?
It is. It really is. And what it all boils down to is humans that in some way or another have barriers in their lives and require their stories to be told and validated so we can remove those barriers so they can be who they want to be.
Are we better at diagnosing it now? I know that in my friend's case, there was an inkling, and there was such a lag between that inkling and being able to get a diagnosis, and then you get the diagnosis and there is a grief almost.
Yeah. We are certainly better at identifying and diagnosing. I wouldn't say that our systems are as responsive as we need to be. We still see years-long waiting lists for diagnosis, and we need to get better at that, and governments of federal, commonwealth, and state do need to get better at that. The experience of knowing and identifying that your child children are developing differently is I can't think of a more deeply profound and human experience to have that love so deep and the fear so great, but at the same time just completely want to support your child. And that's where we can come in and put our arm around them and say things will be okay. And ultimately, we have you as well. We're part of you.
That's beautiful.
I sometimes think when you speak like that, it's good to just leave a beat for us to understand what those words mean. What do you most hope for in the work you do?
I most hope that people can get support when they need it promptly. At the moment, we have people fighting systems, and that's really the next part of what my working life will be. It's about how can we get systems to respond to people when they need it in ways that they need it so kids can grow up to be happy and healthy adults. We're getting better, and certainly I think that our work has been a major catalyst for that. And I think that what we can do is actually make that universal across systems and across life, including up to employment. So we can absolutely cherish and nurture every part of humanity, and we're getting better, but we're not there just yet.
Has becoming a parent made it better or harder? Has it opened the spectrum?
It's changed everything. And there are often, more often now, I go away from families with a bit of a tear in my eye, whereas before I was probably thinking about the next appointment. And I think that's both a challenge but a true privilege, a genuine privilege.
Andrew Whitehouse, I've been talking to you probably for about 12 or 13 years, and the first time you walked into this studio, we had a sense of the remarkable, and it's ever more so. Thanks for coming in. What a pleasure it is to see you.
Thank you.
Professor Andrew Whitehouse. Andrew.